Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we hear from Carrie Brownstein, who joined us in 2016 for Wordstock, Portland's book festival. She was there to discuss her memoir, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl, with writer and filmmaker John Raymond. The conversation ranges from her childhood to the projects she is currently working on, spanning her sprawling career in multiple art forms. The high watermarks are all covered here, including her time in the iconic rock band Sleater-Kinney, her acting and directing in the hit comedy Portlandia, and of course, the celebrated publication of her memoir. But what makes this conversation really worth hearing is that we learn about the lesser-known periods of her life, the moments between the spotlights in which Brownstein is reinventing herself. For example, did you know that she was the Humane Society's Volunteer of the Year in the immediate aftermath of the breakup of Sleater-Kinney? Or that she wrote extensively for NPR on music? Or that she worked briefly in advertising for Portland's Wieden Kennedy? All of this comes out in an intimate and casual interview and helps us get a more complete picture of an important artist, an award-winning musician, actor, director, and of course, writer. Here's Brownstein in conversation with John Raymond.
All right. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
This is so exciting. I remember the first time I heard of Sleater-Kinney in the offices of Snipe Hunt magazine. Does anyone here remember Snipe Hunt magazine? It could be that me and Carrie are possibly the only ones. It was a very cool magazine. And I remember Kathy Malloy, you had come in and visited, and she was like, these guys are going to totally, like, do something. And then you did. It was amazing. Destiny was foretold.
She called it first. Well, I think that I remember Snipe Hunt because in the early days of Sleater-Kinney, and this was very, very early, like before Janet joined, probably 1995, I was living in Olympia, Washington, and going to college up there, and Snipe Hunt was at this place called Rainy Day Records,
yes.
And I would look through places like that, or Punk Planet, or Maximum Rock and Roll, looking for reviews, and reviews took up about this much space.
Yeah.
They were very small, because they were reviewing like 307 inches.
They did like everything, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so thanks, yeah. Snipe Hunt.
Yeah.
We're going to keep it this inside the whole time.
Yeah, exactly, just, yeah. But no, it's so exciting to talk to Carrie today as a memoirist and as a writer and at a writing festival. And so we're going to begin our conversation digging into her excellent book, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl, fresh out in paperback. And I wonder, would you read a small little bit for us just to savor, just to whet everyone's, you know, appetite a little bit?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. All right. John has picked a section that I've never read before. So, I mean, not out loud. I have. It would be amazing to admit right now that this had all been ghostwritten, and I was like, oh my God, what is this? I like.
This was the gotcha moment I've been waiting for.
Yeah. Just checking. Oh, okay. What is this? All right. here we go. By sixth grade, I had two best friends, one of whom, Tammy, was the first person I knew whose parents were divorced. She lived with her mom. Tammy was also the first kid I knew who lived in an apartment. At that age, I thought apartments were built specifically to house the single or the newly single, a divorced dormitory of sorts. Tammy was cute and tough, with freckles and an upturned ski jump nose, her bangs bleached tangerine from hydrogen peroxide and sprayed into an upright, frozen wave. Her mom was a smoker, also a rarity to me in the Pacific Northwest suburbs, but I liked the lived-in quality the smell of nicotine brought to their place, a gritty, world-weary sophistication. Plus, we stole her mom's cigarettes so that we could smoke in parks on weekends. Smoking for me meant blowing outward, like you would on a kazoo. In my mind, it still looked cool, and I was too afraid to inhale. I credit this early exposure to cigarettes with removing any desire to be a smoker later in life. Parents, take note. When Tammy arrived at Benjamin Rush Elementary, the rumor was that she had already lost her virginity. She tacitly and vaguely confirmed this to be true, though I still think the whole story might have been fabricated. I figured it might be a case of crafty social maneuvering on her part, a self-mythologizing that is granted to or required by kids who transfer schools. Or maybe Tammy was trying to suggest that she had some sort of street cred, which is one way a kid with lower economic status gets on equal footing with the middle-class kids. Anything that smelled of real-life experience or hardship, the more exotic and subversive, the better. The comfortable suburban kids held in high esteem. This notion of personal transformation and redefinition is what drew me to Tammy. There was a boldness, a mystery, and a whole lot of not giving a shit. It was Tammy who orchestrated my first kisses and makeouts. Together we attended summer camp. Me so I could shoot bows and arrows, sing Harry Chapin's Cats in the Cradle in a round, and make lanyards. Her so she could meet boys from other schools and gargle with someone else's tongue. Eventually, I decided that holding hands with a guy in a turtleneck and shorts in the middle of the woods and dancing to Depeche Mode in the mess hall was more fun than canoeing or collecting clams on the beach, though it would always be in the back of my mind that I hadn't showered or been able to go to the bathroom for over 5 days. After camp on a springtime backyard tent sleepover, Tammy arranged for a group of boys to sneak in. She instructed each of us, paired us up, and told us how to use our tongues when we kissed, which as a preteen is an unrelenting technique that requires one's mouth to be open longer and wider than during a dental exam. Tammy zipped herself into a sleeping bag with a boy. The rest of us were sitting upright, not sure what to do horizontally, and thus not wanting to commit to one person. We traded kisses in a humid tent that smelled of Dracar Noir, cigarettes, and mint liqueur. Almost immediately, I cut the lips of a kid named Ricky with my braces. I retired for the night. I felt inept at this carefree, outdoorsy group sexiness, but I made an eager, loyal follower. I liked being part of a gang.
Thank you so much. It's just such killer writing. It's so great. And I guess my first like real question just has to do with your writing process. I'm curious like how much you kind of heard this in your head before you'd begun writing, or like how you sort of found it in the process. I mean, you talk a lot in the book about sort of finding your musical sound with Corin and a sort of organic process that took place there. But I wonder if there were kind of templates or inspirations or just some kind of, you know, tone that you knew you wanted before you even began.
Sure. Well, when I was in between sort of the first iteration of Slater-Kinney and the second, I started writing for NPR Music. I wrote a blog called Monitor Mix. And I realized that the work and the pieces that people were most drawn to always incorporated my own narrative. Mm-hmm. And so when I would, you know, try to take this kind of objective, you know, journalistic tone, or even kind of veer into something vaguely academic, that there was a coldness to it, and it really didn't feel authentic. Whenever I drew from my own experience and kind of weaved that into the story of seeing a band or why I related to a certain city or, you know, show or whatnot, I found that I was creating a conversation with an audience, and that kind of connection was something that I was always seeking, you know, in Slater-Kinney, and then I sort of found it in this blogging. And there's something really nice and fluid about blogging because the conversation sort of continues in the comments and it feels very ongoing and mutable in a way that's really nice. And so I really credit that time with kind of finding my voice as a writer and realizing that, you know, I could still thematize things, but it could be conversational and there could be an openness and a vulnerability that wasn't, you know, detrimental, that wasn't sort of laying me open in this way that was like, you know, oh, I'm just writing in my journal or something, you know, right. that there was an art to it, and there was an intentionality to it, but to not lose sight of, I guess, that kind of porous quality.
Yeah. And so then we decided to move that into like the book length project. Did you consciously think of like entering into the rock memoir? Like, was there a kind of like, there was there like, I want to do something new and different with that genre, which, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm really lacking knowledge in the rock memoir, which is probably good. I mean, I love Just Kids by Patti Smith. I read Dylan's Chronicles, but I never read Hammer of the Gods.
Have you read The Dirt?
By Motley Crue.
Yeah. It's a really good one.
Well, I knew what it was when you met it. When you, I know that there's a part where they snort ants because they're out of cocaine.
That was I think Ozzy was responsible for that.
Right.
Snorting a lot of ants.
So I guess, to be fair, my book is not like that. And it's not like Hammer of the Gods, which is the Led Zeppelin biography. So I wanted it to be writerly. I didn't think that Sleater-Kinney was a band that necessarily fell into some of those cliches that people really associate with the rock bio. And I was very encouraged by and excited to be with an imprint like Riverhead that is very literary. And one thing I talked to Jeff Klosky, who my editor, about, you know, and that he was very encouraging of, is just, you know, we want this to be an introduction to an audience of you as a writer, not necessarily, yeah, this is a band and here's, you know, sort of a timeline.
Yeah.
So that, I think, I really just...
Not the rock bio. So how about, though, I'm curious about, like, some other sorts of contemporary, newer sort of memoiristic writing. Like, I know you and Maggie Nelson are friends, and I wonder, like, there's something about her writing that is also a similar combination of, like, cerebral and somatic, you know, like, it's her life, her body, but like clearly someone thinking very hard about the experiences. Like, I wonder if there were... non-rock writing kinds of influences that might have inspired you in the conception.
Yeah, I mean, I do like that hybridity that Maggie Nelson brings to her work. That was definitely influential. Like the Brain Dead Megaphone by George Saunders, you know, just that kind of essay writing. But even, you know... like authors like Laurie Moore, when people can insert, you know, a sense of absurdity and humor into something that has a depth that courses through it. And in terms of, you know, memoir, I really liked this book. I remember reading Jill Kerr Conway's Road to Corrine or Maxine Hong Kingston's Warrior Woman. You know, there was, but certainly, you know, Kim Gordon's book came out right before mine, and I had read hers in early incarnations of it. So yeah, I think a lot of things influenced it. But that hybridity, I guess, has always been appealing to me of being able to insert something in it that, you know, feels a little intellectual, but you're couching it in a way that's like, you know what, I'm not the authority on this, you know, but my experience tells me this.
Yeah, cool. Okay, and then because this is a writing event, like, can we nerd out on process a little bit? And like, can you tell us a little bit about like just the day-to-day writing of the book? Like, how did you do it?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's probably a lot of writers in here, I assume. I mean, there is just no like special shortcut that I feel like everyone is always looking for, like some key that's going to unlock this like door to the muse and creativity. And, you know, certainly there are moments of inspiration, but for me, it was getting up. I mean, I think better in the morning. Sometimes, as I was nearing a deadline or felt that I was sort of on a roll, I would set my alarm for 4:45 or 5 in the morning. I get up pretty naturally around 6 or 6:30. So 5 is pushing it. But I wanted to get a couple hours of writing in. My animals are part of my methodology. I have these two dogs, and I would sort of get up and have coffee. I would not look at the internet. Like, I really had to sort of starve myself of all of these kind of, you know, riches and distractions. Because this is what procrastination's like, as many of you know. Like, it starts out very high-minded. You're like, I'm going to check the New York Times. It's very, very edifying.
Yeah.
And then, like, a second later, you're ordering, like, creams on Amazon and, like, you know, and, like, it's 5 hours later, and you're just like, I don't, and then you're like, I guess I'm done. It's like there's also something about being in front of your computer that just feels like work no matter what you're doing. You're like, another day done. And you're it's like, oh, you know. Like updating Twitter is not a job for most of us. I really had to just kind of put these blinders on. But so I would work for a couple hours, then I would take the dogs out, and often I would I'd go out on hikes, these sort of off-leash, ambulatory jaunts, and try not to bring my phone and come back and write a little more. And if you're done by one, you can just kind of drink the rest of the day, and that gets you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the joke about screenwriting. What do you do for the other 24 hours? Yeah. And then did it change a lot in editing? Did you have a good editing relationship? Mm-hmm. Was that like a important phase for you?
I feel like the rewrite and the rewriting process is, I mean, that to me is the most gratifying process, because the work is there and it's getting in and shaping it and really like making it shimmer, and you know that to me, I really enjoyed that. And I had my editor at Riverhead is great, but I had a reader, a dear friend of mine, Chelsea Johnson, who is actually a Portlander or lived here for many years. She now is a professor on the East Coast, but I had someone who I was sort of sending sometimes daily updates to and chapters, and that process was really important.
Yeah. Does the prose writing does it bear any relationship to songwriting? Like, is there...
No.
Totally different, yeah.
I mean, I wish it did, because there is something... Like, there is nothing to my mind about writing that feels as good as just sitting around with a guitar on a couch. Like, you can really trick yourself. Yeah. I mean, and we've seen people that have tricked themselves into thinking that we all want to hear them playing on a couch for hours. We've been at those parties. There is just no equivalent... this is so fun. I'm just like tapping away on the computer, know.
I'm just gonna riff a little here.
Yeah, like that. Wow, that is. In fact, that could be like a real like recipe for some dark depression. Just if you started to think that was fun. So yeah, no, I wish. Songwriting reaches that stage of frustration, and it certainly takes. It's a craft, and it takes a lot of diligence. But there is something about music that, for the sake of playing, can sometimes be a relief. And I don't usually find that with writing.
Yeah. Okay. Would you read us another little bit?
Sure.
All right. We're going to sort of use the bits. We're going to use the writing to kind of pivot into some different topics.
Like, pivot is a triggering word now from the debates. Like,
yeah. Let's not pivot into that, though.
Yeah. No, we won't. But, like, I felt like that word was totally safe, like, until, like, a month ago. Okay, John is doing some deep cuts from the book. Also, I just really want to apologize. I didn't think anyone was going to be able to see these socks, which don't match.
It's being recorded for radio, so it's fine.
Oh, yeah. Radio people, I'm wearing a beautiful sheer sock. Okay. This is from the end of the book. It's called Shelter. People always ask me if I was sad when Slater-Kinney broke up. Mostly I felt a sense of relief. My grief was on hold, my emotions compartmentalized and transferred. The band was a phantom limb. I could still feel it there. I didn't really believe that it was gone, but mostly I ignored it. In a small room on the second floor of my house, a former attic built out by the previous owners, with slanted ceilings and corners only accessible by crawling, I placed a striped wool rug, a guitar, and a lone amplifier. The only time I entered the room was to pet my cat, Hector, who often sat in there atop a carpeted cat condo and watched over the contents of the space like a furry museum guard. Instead of playing or thinking about music, I dove into my volunteer work at the Oregon Humane Society, which is just about the only way I knew how to deal with the loss. If you're wondering how sad I was, you'd never know by talking to me. But you would know it by the fact that I won the Oregon Humane Society Volunteer of the Year Award in 2006. I clocked in over 100 hours that year. I developed new programs to help long-term canine shelter residents get adopted. I made laminated flyers replete with photos I took of the dogs and added pat, inspirational, and euphemistic phrases like, if you love a toothy kiss, you'll love Buster. I walked them on the shelter grounds and even took them on field trips. I taught the more rambunctious dogs to sit, wait, go to their bed, how to walk better on the leash. I sat in the lobby wearing my teal volunteer apron with two large front pockets, gritty with dog remnants, torn and gooey from overeager puppy mouths, stretched from too much wear and not enough washing. I greeted customers in the lobby, grateful to be in a uniform, just one of many anonymous and near invisible, in a place where frumpiness and depression thrive. The dogs I brought with me to the lobby were my interlocutors, my translators. They bounded up to customers and I channeled their optimism. They lived in the moment, grateful for the interaction, and so was I. I had a purpose, even if part of that purpose was hosing down feces-covered kennels. The dogs' needs seemed simple, and I required simple needs, to have somewhere to be. It's easy to feel sated when all you're asking for in life is food, water, and some gentle petting. I befriended the older women who made up the majority of the other volunteers, retirees and former powerhouses in realms like consulting and finance, bored at home, sapped by stale marriages, with reticent or far-flung adult children, and ill or dying friends. These women felt useful and appreciated. We formed a constellation of surrogates who likely should have been paying the dogs for therapy. It could have funded the entire shelter operation. We cried when dogs were euthanized, but also when they were adopted. We had been seeking comfort in the constant and could barely deal with change. The term shelter seemed to apply as much to the humans as it did to the animals.
Something that I personally find so inspiring about your work in general is the capacity to reinvent that you have shown. And like, you know, the music obviously is the foundation, but that kind of restlessness and that kind of recreation that you've shown is like really so remarkable. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, just sort of talk us through that period a little bit of after the band and that kind of this period that you're reading about here, of just sort of starting to pull together the pieces about what you want to do next, and like, were there moments or were there particular fantasies that sort of maintained you through that period? Because right. It wasn't like, it's not like you knew that some next thing was going to happen. You had to like create it.
Yeah, well, there is a precedent to this time in my life, and this was about, let's see, this was 2006. But in the, I think around 2000 or 2001, my bandmate Corin had her first child, and you know, she sort of announced it, and it was a surprise. We're going to go on this, you know, hiatus while she, you know, gave birth and spent the first, you know, 6-8 months raising her kid and enjoying being a new mom. And she told me like on a Monday, and by Tuesday I had like 4 jobs. Like I was like an emergency substitute teacher. I like acted in like a really bizarre indie film. This is all up in Olympia. And, you know, I became like a research assistant to my professor. Like I have sort of this panic that comes with stillness.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of, I'm wary of it a little bit. So I knew when the band ended that it would be just a small amount of time before I like flung myself headfirst into many, many different endeavors. The volunteer work was intense. I mean, it was, you know, 100 hours is kind of a lot to log in a volunteer job. I started doing like dog training. Like I still run into people in Portland that are like, you trained my dog. Do you remember Buster? And I'm like, oh yeah, hey buddy. You know, like I do sometimes remember the dogs. I remember them specifically if people like brought them to the class on their bike. You know, then I'm like, yes, I remember you for sure. Dogs love riding on bikes, you know, stuff like that. So I did that. I worked at Wieden & Kennedy for 6 months. And then I started writing for NPR. But I didn't really know. There was definitely sort of a moment, not of panic, but just of uncertainty. And I tried to make use of that. I mean, I think those kind of moments in our life can be very useful.
Yeah.
Because it's often when you are in a you know, sort of a moment that is unstable, you know, when you're faltering. And that's when the choreography changes. You know, we get so used to this kind of choreography of our days. And you know, we sort of reenact these same patterns for better or worse. And when something, you know, is pulled out from underneath you, the steps change.
Yeah.
And I tried to think of that as a gift, and it did turn out to be that.
Yeah.
But it's there was definitely, you know, some soul searching and just, you know, yeah, logistically yeah. figuring things out.
Yeah. What were the ambitions when you first began doing stuff with Fred with the comedy and stuff? Was that like,
yeah.
I mean, what was, did you have a sense that this was going to unfold into something as big as it has? Like, I mean, was there some like deep fancy, like, oh yeah, this is gonna, you know, there's a way I could see this really doing something, or was it, yeah?
Not at all. I mean, in the same, I'm very lucky in the sense that, you know, these two sort of major collaborative processes in my life, one with Corin and Janet, and then the other with Fred, you know, grew from a very organic place.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
it's pretty rare in it's not as rare in music, but it's fairly rare in television or film to have something come to fruition that starts, you know, not with agents or other people sort of placing you together or pairing you up, but with, you know, we just were making videos online, you know,
yeah.
when Slater Kinney was still a band.
Yeah.
And eventually we just sort of had enough to pitch it as a show. And that was, you know,
yeah.
surprising too. So it kind of had the same feeling of sort of discovering what it was as it was being created.
Yeah, yeah. And you talk, you speak so eloquently in the book about the kind of evolution of the collaboration with Corin and Janet and the tensions and the triumphs and all that kind of stuff. How has the collaboration evolved with Fred then as the show has gone on for multiple generations and has become like a you know, what started with two people has become like a cottage industry, you know? And like, I just wonder, how do you protect the collaboration? How do you keep it fresh? Like, is there any talk about it? Maybe it just happens organically.
No, I mean, I think like with any relationship, I mean, it takes a certain amount of work. It takes reassessing and a certain amount of, you know, continued discourse in terms of what is the process and how do we protect this. And I think there is, with anything, like you have to kind of take care of it.
Yeah.
You know, you have to check in. I think things can easily sort of grow stale, or you can, you know, just find yourself, you know, in a place of distance with someone else through almost, you know, inadvertently, you know,
yes.
just realizing that you've sort of drifted. So I feel very protective. And I think I learned that through Slater Kinney because,
yeah.
you know, we went through this slightly traumatic, you know, break in 2006 that I write a lot about in this book. And kind of what we each learned from that was that we had started to really take for granted this whole, you know, endeavor, the whole sort of body of the band was something that we had sort of, you know, let this illness kind of grow inside. And so I feel much more sensitive and attuned to protecting those collaborations.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I want to talk about your future projects right
okay.
now. Yeah.
I thought you were just going to say, like, I want to talk about your future, and then you were going to,
yeah.
like, do some predictions.
Yeah,
some
exactly,
kind of,
yeah.
Like...
This is going to be a Karnak thing here, yeah.
yeah.
the work you've done, you know, through Portlandia has obviously, like, created a whole new creative muscles for yourself. I mean, there are, like, so many more things you're able to do. And, I mean, I'm curious, like, about, like, the acting work that you've been doing on Transparent or something. How did that come about, for one thing? And is there any way in which it has some of those same organic seeds that your other projects have? Or is this, you know, moving into, like, a different phase of making?
With Transparent, Jill Soloway, who's the creator of that show, she and I had sort of been following each other's careers and work for a while, and we met up, and she... I read the pilot, which was beautiful, and she, they ended up doing some reshoots on the pilot, and she said, I think I'm going to create this character that's Allie's best friend, and, you know, what do you think of like being involved in that and playing that character. So we talked about it. It's quite different from my other jobs because I get to sort of sit and help make someone else's vision come true. And sort of come to fruition, realization. Like I don't have to, I can just immerse myself in it in a much different way. I can sort of tune out the analytical part. Like when we're filming Portlandia, I'm often, like this year I did some directing on it and I'm thinking about it in terms of directing and writing and even producing sometimes. It's just, I'm wearing multiple hats and that sometimes disallows sort of, you know, like a full kind of, you know, deep dive into just the acting of it. Whereas with Jill, I could just trust her vision so implicitly, and there was a certain amount of like of leaps that I could take.
Yeah, right. I'll say I found it interesting, like in reading the book, part of the book that is a very elegant and beautiful section. It was about Carrie's dad coming out as a 55-year-old, and which I found interesting than watching Transparent, where that similar kind of storyline is happening. And I wonder, like, does the personal and performative kind of inform each other for you in that? I mean, it's not your role exactly, but it's just I found it interesting that that is still a storyline that you're living inside of. Like, is there any way that your own life comes to bear on those? Like acting on the acting work in that? Like, I don't know if that's even a question exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it sounded like a question.
Yeah.
But like I said, my dad came out as a 55-year-old as if he'd been hiding as a different age for years and years.
Yeah, right.
And then was just like, I have something to tell you. I'm 55.
Yeah. That did actually happen to my sister once. She had a boyfriend who had been saying he was 23 and ended up being 35. It was like he had a whole life in there.
That's a cautionary tale for all of us, I think. I guess better that he was 35 and not like 15.
Exactly.
There's just, you got to be thankful for those little things. Anyway, my dad came out as gay at 55. One thing that Jill Solo and I talked about when we met up was she sort of knew that we would have this similar, like she knew we had these similar histories and was curious to talk to me about it. So yeah. I think she knew that I would relate to the story of Maura Pfefferman on a personal level of just sort of getting to know someone anew that you took for granted as knowing. And I think there is something very disorienting and about having, and almost to the point of, like, not necessarily resentment, but it's just, it almost feels like an affront to your whole sort of history to, like, I have to get to know my parents again. You know, like, this was a relationship that I thought was sort of fixed. And, of course, it's a fallacy to think that any relationship we have with anyone is fixed or that we would want anyone as a being to be fixed. Of course, we want this, you know, ability for transformation. But I think we do there is this assumption, especially with our families, which I think is a lot where a lot of the tension comes from, that we can sort of count on them as these certain sort of, you know, monolithic entities in our lives. So, certainly, you know, even just operating within the fictional world of the Pfefferman family, I think I definitely brought to my character just that kind of sense of... I guess openness, you know, like I felt fortunate that I didn't have to play that. You know, my character wasn't dealing with a family member who had gone through, a transformation in this case on the show, gender, that I could actually come at it from the outside and have sort of the ability to be sympathetic and to be grateful and to see it as a positive thing, because I think when you're in that, you can really get caught up in the ways that it's sort of undermining and dismantling your own sense of personal history.
Yeah. I mean, I think the show does such a subtle and beautiful job of thematizing all that. So you have been directing some episodes of Portlandia, and also you just directed a short film. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the short film that is now available for view? Don't look at it right now on your phones, but...
That'd be amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I made a short film for a brand called Kenzo, and the creative directors, Carol Lim and Umberto Leon, have been collaborating with various people, Spike Jones or Greg Araki, and making these shorts. And what was really wonderful about it was they allowed me total creative control. You know, the only sort of limitations, or I guess it had to be within their world in terms of the aesthetic, yeah. The clothing in particular. But I basically wrote a short film that kind of deals with fandom, or does deal with fandom, which is actually what a lot of my book deals with too. I feel like I'm someone that is kind of a believer in the ways that being a fan of something is a form of optimism and openness, and I think curiosity is such an important aspect to human nature. You know, it allows, because it's, to be curious about something is to take a step forward, and I think it's so easy to not. I feel like I'm always seeking things to discover.
And like an atavistic thing where you like are becoming the thing that you're a fan of in a way. Like, I feel like that's a beautiful thing that comes out in your book often, that you're like the sort of work of self-creation. Like even in that first section that you read of, you know, your childhood friends kind of, you know, learning these new ways of being. It's such a recurrent motif. It's really beautiful. Yeah.
So the film has a lot to do with that, except it sort of takes a dark turn. But
it's funny too.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I think it does start from that place of thinking about the ways that, you know, fandom is sort of equated with, I guess, just kind of keeping cynicism at bay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so does the directing thing, is that, are there new vistas out there? Like, are there... larger directorial projects that are in our future?
I'm going to direct something at the end of this year that I can't talk about yet. It's nothing like crazy. Like, you're not you're not going to read it and be like, oh my God. Like, you actually will not read about it. But I just can't mention it. Directing to me feels like a natural extension of the writing that I do in terms of, in especially the screenwriting and teleplay writing and whatnot. And I really enjoyed directing the short film and Portlandia, because it's just being able to tell the story visually when you've already put it on the page.
And how about future writing, like book writing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I am writing another book. I just, officially signed on to do another book, and it will be essays, and I'm really excited to do that. I'm really it also means that I get to stay up in Portland, which is a great place to write, because of the great weather here, and
there's nothing else to do.
Yeah. And the way seasonal depression just lends itself to, you know, feeling inspired and yep, just sitting under my UV lamp and taking my vitamin D and just, you know. So I have writing coming up, which I'm excited about.
Does fiction writing, interest you? Like, is that, like, a...
I mean, if in terms of television and screenwriting, yes.
But not in terms of, like, a novel or story.
Yet. Yeah. I just feel like there's so many great... When I read a great book, I just think that's... It's like it's sort of like a magic, a world of magic that I just never want to know the answers to. Like, I feel very...
Oh, that's interesting, huh?
Yeah, I'm really okay with that. I think it's, you know.
Yeah.
No, not gonna. No plans.
Okay, so what are some magical book reading experiences you've had lately? As you know, are there any suggestions for our audience right now?
In the new year, you will be gifted with the new George Saunders book, which is called Lincoln and the Bardo. Wow. And this is not an exaggeration. It is a masterpiece. It is his first novel. It's unreal.
I can't wait.
It is magical.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough to read it because I participated in the audiobook.
Oh.
And Yeah. Anyway, that is a brilliant book. The new Zadie Smith book, which will be out pretty soon, Swing Time, is also wonderful. And then what else am I reading right now? I was just reading this. I was reading some Jane Jacobs' Economy of Cities, which is always interesting. And yeah, that's actually. And I'm reading this Ursula K. Le Guin, like her sort of compendium of her talks that she did between like 2000 and 2013. I think she's published a series of those, and this is like the most recent one. And she just has so many wonderful things to say about writing and imagination and pedagogy. It's just, I mean, it's just lots of nuggets of inspiration.
Yeah, she is a goddess.
She is.
I know. I'm not kidding. I mean, it's like we're honored to live in the same space-time continuum.
Same world, yeah.
Yeah. I have been. I have received the signal that it's question time.
Oh my God! It went so fast. Hopefully for you guys too.
Yeah.
Oh God.
For you. Yeah. So yeah, we're going to open things up to audience questions. Perhaps I will point at people if they raise their hands. Yeah, front row.
As I was reading your book, I noticed really strong motifs of hunger going through it. Obviously, that's in the title as well. And I found myself wondering about, you know, how that must feel to have those motifs be cropping up as you're thinking about your own life. Because it's so well structured that it almost felt like it could be fiction between, you know, how it weaves through your mother's illness and then your discussion of ambition in Olympia.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think sometimes with memoir, there's sort of this mischaracterization of it, that it sort of lacks this intentionality, or that you're not building like a very specific narrative. And I certainly did, you know, thinking about the theme of hunger, it came up over and over again, the notions of, you know, going from feeling disembodied to embodied, you know, so much of that just... you know, these sort of ways that we feel a lacking or a paucity, and how we make sense of that and fill ourselves up sometimes with things that lack nourishment, and ideally with things that and people that and who do. So, yeah, I mean, I very purposely chose vignettes from my life that kind of circled around that theme, but without being so, you know, you want to feel like there's alacrity and a nimbleness in your prose and in your writing, so that you're not, you know, it's not a thesis where you're just kind of circling back, like, well, here's a theme, I want to drive that home. But I think, you know, giving shape to the narrative was very important to me, and that was pointed.
It's a really elegantly constructed book for all of you who have not read it yet. There are, like, The themes shift and mutate in really beautiful ways.
I think the tricky thing is when you write a memoir, that people think that it's just a journal, like you're just kind of transcribing from a journal, which would be horrifying. Like most of us don't want to read anyone else's journal. I mean, or shouldn't want to. I mean, we see that a lot. I feel like we're really exposed to a lot of people treat, I think, social media like a diary a little bit.
Right.
Mostly for better or worse, mostly for worse. But I mean, I'm guilty of it too. I'm just like, why do people care what I ate for breakfast? Oh, they're going to. You know, you're just like,
they might.
It's so hubristic, but
you got to keep feeding it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yep. Anyway.
Okay. Yes. How about red shirt back?
Just to put you completely on the spot, would you like a writing buddy this winter while you're here in Portland?
I have two writing buddies. They're four-legged and furry, and what I love is that we don't talk. But I say sincerely, thank you for the offer.
You can point to people.
Oh no, it's better to put the pressure on you to be like the chooser.
Yeah, this is.
I feel like in some ways you've kind of become the Garrison Keillor of Portland. People have said that they have moved. Well, I mean, I've heard people say that they moved to Minneapolis because of the tales that Garrison Keillor spins, and then they get disappointed because it's not like Lake Wobegon. Do you feel like you're going to be able to maintain your the kind of sort of be protected in Portland from us, you know, from those of us who
moved here, that sort of thing. Wait, what? What was the last part?
If you feel like you're going to be continue to feel sort of safe in your privacy and personal personhood here in Portland with...
Because Garrison Keillor was devoured by his neighbors.
Yeah, I mean, you know what happened to Garrison Keillor. They ate him alive. Your question got more and more threatening. You were like, are you going to feel safe in your house tonight? Apparently not. I cannot leave the Northwest. I've tried many times. I grew up outside Seattle. I went to college in Washington. I've lived here, moved here in 2001. It really is home for me. And I think we've all seen the way it's changed, and it was changing well before, I began a conversation with that change, which is what I think Portlandia is. It really has been a conversation about who we are and, you know, for me, a questioning of privilege and a questioning of, you know, that very sense of safety that I think a lot of people feel here that is at odds with the rest of the country. I think that's one of the reasons people look at Portland as such an interesting place, because some of our concerns here are not of everyone, because we can't generalize, but I think a lot of the things that we get hyper-concerned about, you know, local versus organic, or a new grocery store going in, or, you know, like, I think people are often thinking, wow, are those actually, like, you guys have so much privilege that that's all you're worried about? And you know what? That's not all we're worried about. But I think that there is, I think a lot of us are starting to just have a conversation with what it means to live here, to live in any of the communities across America that are changing. I think, you know, Portlandia becomes an easy scapegoat for, you know, the rapidity of people moving here. The statistics don't bear that out, but I do think that what makes people uncomfortable is that it is a show that reflects back something that people don't want to admit they're part of, to be honest.
Yeah.
And, you know, but yeah, I feel safe here. I mean, I feel like I've... I don't know. I mean, maybe I shouldn't, but... But maybe none of us should. I think that's the point.
Yes, how about you in the front?
One of the things I really enjoyed about your book was the trips on the road and just reading it through the different albums, and that was one of the things I really enjoyed. You mentioned about, like, kind of an anxiety of standing still, and can you talk a little bit about your life and where you're at now, like, looking back at how has that kind of changed? And
well, I still feel quite peripatetic by nature. I do think that I toured in the band so much in my formative years that I like having the perspective on home that being away brings, and vice versa. I think what's changed is I used to think that fulfillment was sort of anathema to creativity. You know, that, like, contentment. I think many of us in, like, formative years, or when we feel sort of more restless or agitated, you know, the notion that, you know, being contented in any way is sort of at odds with the process of creating, that creation has to come from a place of sorrow or darkness, or and sometimes it does. And I wouldn't say, I think, I don't know if I'll ever feel content, but I do think feeling fulfilled is something that I seek. And I think the trick for me has been realizing that, you know, fulfillment doesn't come in the same shape or form for all of us. It's really hard as an artist to sort of look out and see these, you know, other people choose things different from yourself. And so, like, seeking fulfillment is, I think, okay. And I think part of that, it helps, I think, with the artistic process, because it is a searching. And I think that has helped with the writing, is realizing that, like, searching for moments of goodness, moments of compassion, moments of kindness, I think are just as fruitful as searching for moments that are withering. So, I try to focus on kindness and compassion as much as I can as a source of inspiration.
Yeah.
So.
That seems like a very lovely, inspirational place for us to close this conversation.
Let's get out. Okay, do not come after me. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Carrie Brownstein, so much.
Thanks, John Raymond. Thank you.
That was Carrie Brownstein in conversation with John Raymond at Wordstock, Portland's book festival in 2016. The Wordstock 2017 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place on November 11th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.